So that's a very good book. I have some handouts with information. Jeff, could you hand these out too? Thank you. Okay. So this information was compiled from 4 hours of lectures that I did on church history. You can't hear? Is this better? All right. Raise your hand and say, Shane, I can't hear you. All right, this isn't going to work so well. Okay. We're going to talk about, basically, this is titled, The Church of Scotland to the RPCNA. Because the roots of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in North America go back to the Scottish Reformation in the 16th century. There are several points that I want to highlight, and so that you can remember, because these are significant key points in our history. I've divided this presentation up based upon these points. The first one is there are two Scottish Reformations. The first Scottish Reformation was a reformation of the gospel, recovering the gospel from its distortion by the Roman Catholic Church. The second Scottish Reformation is this other dark line. It's a reformation of government. So the first Reformation was the gospel. The second Reformation was an establishment of Presbyterian church government. And then we'll talk briefly about where this our church standards come from, the Westminster Confession of Faith. And then there'll be a period at the bottom, the Scottish Covenanters, which is just a short period of time, what happened after the Second Reformation until we get into our, on the backside, the origin of the RPCNA. And then last, we'll cover some interesting points about our history that you might not know or maybe be interested in being reminded of. So 16th century Scotland was a pretty dark place. The Roman Catholic Church owned more than half of the land. I've been trying to think of a way to describe it, but on the eastern side of Scotland, you have Edinburgh. It's one of the two largest cities in Scotland. North of there is a city called St. Andrews. It's about an hour north of Edinburgh. Prince William actually happened to go there to school. But there, if you stand you also know St. Andrews because that's where the British Open is held every year. That's the rest of the world understands that, connect St. Andrews to golf. We connect it to the first Scottish Reformation. But there's a cathedral on a point in St. Andrews, and it's like a quarter mile long, but it's only ruins now, and it has the towers on each side, and they're huge. And when you think about medieval Scotland in the early 16th century, it's like maybe having the Westin in your neighborhood, okay? This Westin hotel, and that's how the cities were designed. The Roman Catholic Church overpowered the rest of the people and held everyone in slavery. Well, if you were a noble, you were able to go to a university on the continent in Paris or Germany or France or somewhere, or Paris or Germany or Holland or wherever the universities have been established. And there's a guy named Patrick Hamilton. And he went to Germany and he studied under Martin Luther, who basically lit up the Scottish the Protestant Reformation in 1517. But there, Patrick Hamilton learned this doctrine of justification by faith, because the Roman Catholic Church had been teaching that you are basically saved by your own works. Okay. And so Patrick Hamilton brought this doctrine back in a Roman Catholic world, remember? He taught in the university at St. Andrews the doctrine of justification by faith. And Cardinal Beaton, who was the Roman Catholic leader at the time, a bishop, he martyred him and he burned him on the stake. And so in 1523, you have this first man that brought the doctrine of justification by faith from Luther in Germany over to Scotland in St. Andrews, and he was burned at the stake. Well, George Wishart had seen this, and he was a priest, and he began to study the scripture, and he was convicted by the faith of this man who was burned because he wouldn't recant his belief of doctrine of justification. And he preached the gospel. And he had this stout man that carried a broadsword as his bodyguard. His name was John Knox. And Cardinal Beaton, he called George Wishart, who'd been out preaching the gospel in the university and the churches, to come and debate and discuss these doctrines. And George Wishart knew it was a death sentence. But so he had John Knox stay away. And he went to go with hope to try to discuss the doctrines of salvation and justification by faith. And instead of coming out with the Roman Catholic Church repenting, he was burned at the stake in St. Andrews as well in 1546. So you have these two guys that start preaching the gospel, and the Roman Church kills them to try to silence them. In 1546, just after George Wishart was killed, three men, John Leslie, Peter Carmichael, and James Melville, they snuck into St. Andrew's Castle and murdered Cardinal Beaton. Because they had he had basically held Scotland under tyranny, and they sieged the St. Andrew's Castle. So now you have these early reformers taking control of the castle. And then this guy, John Knox, who was the bodyguard of George Wishart, he comes in and he takes refuge in St. Andrew's Castle. And he is called to be their pastor. Well, France came to the aid of Scotland, and they bombarded the castle and took everyone prisoner. And this guy named John Knox was served as a galley slave in a French ship for 19 months. Basically, they rowed the ship for 19 months, and there's several interesting anecdotes. But one day, as this French ship came into the harbor of Edinburgh, he said, "I will preach there one day." And it's really interesting to see that prophecy came true. What happened is, after the 19 months, John Knox was freed, but he didn't go back to Scotland. He went to England. He served as a pastor. He worked in the Protestant Reformation the English Reformation with Thomas Cranmer to write the standards of the Church of England. They're called the 39 Articles. And then from 1554 to 1557, Knox fled from Bloody Mary, who was wanting to return the Church of England back to Roman Catholicism, and he lived in Geneva. And does anyone know why it would be significant that this reformer pastor would live in Geneva, Switzerland? John Duke? He met Calvin. John, and there's a Reformation monument in Geneva, and John Knox is on that. It's John Knox, Calvin, Beza, and I think Martin Bucer. Now I can't remember the fourth one. But John Knox, he hung with Calvin and Theodore Beza, and learned all of these. And learned the doctrine, and actually he influenced Calvin in some ways on church government and stuff. So when he returned in 1557 to Scotland, he came back preaching the gospel. And he led the Scotland in this first Reformation. And after 3 years of preaching, Parliament had what is called in history the Reformation Parliament. And they decreed that Protestantism would be the religion of Scotland. They wrote the Scots Confession, basically a confession of faith, and the Church of Scotland is established. Okay, and then in 1581, the Church covenanted with the King to reject Roman Catholicism, and even James the Sixth of Scotland signed it. And basically, this covenant was that the Church would support the king as long as the king did what he would, served as a godly king as God had commanded. And the king would support the church, and there would be this correct relationship where Christ is the head of the church and Christ is the head over king, and they had a covenanted relationship, which is why we're called covenanters. So the gospel was restored in Scotland in 1560 at the First Reformation. Well, things didn't go so well. From 1560 to 1567, the Church of Scotland and the Scottish Parliament fought back and forth to determine the proper relationship. The Church of Scotland was established as the state church, so everyone who went to church was to go to the Church of Scotland. But what happened is the Parliament and others who were influenced by Roman Catholicism in England, they tried to bring what's called Episcopal Church government, which is rule of bishops, where the church is not the people, the church is all the officers, and one bishop can control what goes on in the whole church. And the other beauty of, if you're a king, the other beauty of Episcopal Church government is if you can select this bishop, you can control the church and the government. So there are these battles back and forth from 1567 to 1538. And then what happened in 1536 is Charles I, who was actually a Scottish king that became the King of England, he had his archbishop, Bishop Laud, who's really a bad guy when you look back at history. He was a bishop of the Church of England, and he wanted to return back to Roman Catholicism. So he prepared a Scots book of church law or book of canons, and established again this high church that looks like what we see in the Anglican church, or it was really semi-Catholicism. He established Episcopal church government. He forbid anyone to have private meetings. He forbid extemporaneous prayers. So you had to write your own prayers. Now, it's not necessarily a bad thing if you're leading worship to write down what you want to say in your prayer, but they forbid all of these because men could come up and pray with evangelical faith, and others would be encouraged in their faith. And so, but the people in Church of Scotland thought that this was a return to Roman Catholicism, and they resisted it. Well, Charles I said, all right, you don't have to use it, but every pastor has to buy 2 copies of this book of canons. So he was kind of trying to ease in his desire to return more to Roman Catholicism. And there's a turning point in 1637 in the Second Scottish Reformation. The minister in St. Giles Cathedral, which is the main cathedral just down the street from Edinburgh Castle, the pastor there, he actually used this book of canons, the prayer book, and he read a prayer from it. And people responded in rebellion. And you may have heard a folk story or legend of this little lady named Ginny Geddes, who was sitting on a stool up front. And when he did it, she yelled at him and threw her stool at him. And just it supposedly ignited this rebellion and an uprising of Protestants. Well, Charles I didn't react well to this. Instead of just requiring that everyone purchase the book of canons, he required that everyone use it. And so the Presbyterians, they protested in Edinburgh, and they all marched on Edinburgh, the city and the castle. And at that point, Charles was forced to deal with this rebellion. So he called what's called the Meeting of the Four Tables, and guys like George Gillespie and Alexander Henderson, these major figures in the Scottish Reformation, came together, and they proposed what was needed to be done in the church so that they could return to peace. And Charles I rejected it all. So the church, the people of Scotland got together and they wrote up what's called the National Covenant. And it was publicly sworn at Greyfriars Church in Scotland. Now, has anyone heard of Greyfriars Chapel? What do you know it for? There's a slight story. There's a little monument in front of Greyfriars Chapel in Edinburgh, and it's because there's a guy who died, and his dog would go back there every day for like a year or two and spend the whole day there. That's such a minor event compared to what happened on July 23rd in 1637. They signed this covenant where the church rejected Roman Catholicism. they established Presbyterian church government, and they committed to support the king as long as he submitted to Christ as he did. And there was this correct separation of the church and the state, and the king wouldn't rule over the church. And then later in 1641, the parliament in Scotland actually made a law that if you're going to serve in the government as an official, you have to have signed the national covenant. Basically, you have to be a believer. And what happened? I mean, this is radical when you think about our day, when people say that we're a Christian country. We confessionally aren't really a Christian country. We're a pluralistic country. But Scotland became a Christian country in the Second Scottish Reformation. And it was written down in the law. The relationship between the church and state recognized Christ as king. All right, so is this history familiar? Do you guys have any questions? The first Reformation in 1560 returned to the gospel of justification by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. The second Reformation was more of a reformation of church government so that the church would be Presbyterian. Well, after this happened in 1641, Charles I came up to Scotland to try to attack. All the Covenanters, these people who had signed the Scottish Covenant, resisted him in the southern parts of Scotland and defeated Charles I's army, and he went back. And there were all these differences between the Parliament and Charles. And what happened is we get the English Civil War. Parliament called Scotland to help Parliament fight Charles I in the Civil War. And Scotland, who was confessionally a Christian nation and had Presbyterian government, they said, "We will help you if you unify the Church of England, the Church of Scotland, and the Church of Ireland." And so they signed what's called the Solemn League and Covenant. And so as a result, Scotland sent troops down to work to serve with the army of the Parliament to fight Charles I, the king. And Parliament established what is called the Westminster Assembly of Divines. And six men from Scotland came down to be representatives. Samuel Rutherford, George Gillespie, Alexander Henderson, and Richard Bailey. And now I can't remember the other two guys. But these are big guys in our history and in the Church of Scotland. And they went. And from 1643 to 1649, they worked on the Westminster Confession of Faith. And they worked on the larger catechism. They worked on the Westminster Shorter Catechism. And then they developed a form of church government, which is Presbyterian. They developed a directory of worship. And they did all these things. And the commitment was that the Church of England, the Church of Ireland, and the Church of Scotland would all accept these standards as their confession of faith, their rule of government and worship. And in 1647, the Church of Scotland did adopt this Westminster Confession of Faith and the other doctrines as their confession of the church. Actually, Scotland is the only one that held to the commitment of the Solemn League and Covenant. And so why do we have the Blue Book and why do we refer to the Westminster Confession, the larger catechism, the shorter catechism, and these other documents? It's because we trace our roots back to the Church of Scotland and this excellent confession of faith that was done between 1643 to 1649. And we have held that confession. We've held to those standards those written down beliefs of what the Scripture teaches since then. So if you don't have a constitution, you can get one, and you can see that's what we say we believe about church government, the civil magistrate, justification, adoption, sanctification, creation, who is God, who is Christ, all these things, as well as church government. So this is the Reformation, and this is where our beliefs, our confession of faith came from. Well, after that, Scotland seemed to go pretty well. The church was Presbyterian and prospering, and they were preaching the true gospel. People were becoming believers. And then in 1660, There were some nobles in Scotland that really were convicted that, well, that the rightful government, civil government, was a king, and the rightful king was Charles II, Charles I's son. So what these guys did is they brought him back, and they said to Charles II, who was really a wicked man, if you sign the national covenant and commit to this covenanted relationship between the church and between the state, then we will support you and bring you back. And in 1660, they brought back Charles II to England. And then what he did is he went out and he killed these men, these covenanters that had basically risked their lives to overthrow the Commonwealth in England that ruled over everyone. And Charles II began murdering, basically martyring the covenanters, the Church of Scotland people, the people in the Church of Scotland, anyone basically who confessed Protestantism and Reformed theology. In 1641, 400 ministers were ejected from the Church of Scotland because they would not swear allegiance to Charles II because he had lied in signing the National Covenant and he recanted of that decision. And our pastors, many of the people who became the Reformed Presbytery, were in these 400 men, pastors that were ejected. This is radical. They lost everything. These were men who had a salary, homes and things like that, and a post to minister the gospel. They lost everything. They were impoverished, but they wouldn't compromise the gospel. They wouldn't compromise their faith in the Lordship of Jesus Christ and the mediatorial kingship of Christ. From 1660 to 1690, 18,000 covenanters, which 18,000 of us, died in the Church of Scotland. In Scotland, 18,000 were martyred, and you can read accounts of that in this book, Fair Sunshine. Just to give you an understanding of how radical that is, there were 1 million people in Scotland. 18,000 of those who were Covenanters were martyred. And the deal was, all they had to do was take this oath of abrogation and deny the National Covenant and the Solemn League and Covenant and the Westminster Confession and just go to the Church of England that had been, the Church of Scotland. When you think back of this, these are just farm guys, farm people in southwest Scotland, regular people in the cities. There were nobles and stuff. Robert Lytton, who was one of the two bishops that were set over the Church of Scotland, he was in Glasgow on the eastern side. He went down to Ayr, which is southwest Scotland, to find out why these people were being killed, why they were making these stands to not recant the National Covenant and swear allegiance to Charles II. And he said that he was astonished because the common farmer, the regular Joe in Scotland, could defend his positions from Scripture. So it's somewhat of a different state than we find ourselves today. I think, you know, these were people with true saving faith in Christ, conviction that Christ was their king and their Lord, and they weren't going to compromise, and they can show people where in Scripture their beliefs were grounded. So Robert Lytton went back, and he wasn't able to reconcile the Covenanter Church with the Church of Scotland. Well, peace kind of came through William and Mary, who was King William was basically the savior of the Netherlands. He helped the Reformation of the Netherlands and defeated the Roman Catholics there. But he and Mary came over and defeated James II of England and reestablished peace in England, Scotland, and Ireland. And they went to the Parliament and said, let's figure out a form of church government that everyone will establish peace. And the civil government, civil magistrate, established Presbyterianism. He basically made a law to establish Presbyterianism. And at this point, it would seem that the Covenanters could come back and join the church, but they were convicted of this doctrine of the mediatorial kingship of Christ, that the king is not over the church. Christ establishes the church. And so because we held this belief, we didn't join back in with the Church of Scotland, and we still remained a separate entity that was kicked out. We didn't secede ever, but we, out of conscience, could not join back into the Church of Scotland. And what happened is we entered into a state where we had very few pastors and for a while no pastors. And we began to worship in what are called societies of like groups of people where there was a ruling elder and they would meet weekly and discuss the scriptures and pray in formal worship. And then in 1743, finally two pastors were raised up. One pastor came from the Church of Scotland and he was convicted of the positions of the covenants and he was convicted of the truth of the national covenant. And he came over and joined. And then there was another pastor that was ordained on the continent in Netherlands, and they actually established what's called the Reformed Presbytery. And so our church kind of took form again, in 1743. And then there was a guy named John Cuthbertson in 1747, and he was ordained and also in this church. And we have now the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Scotland. So first and second Scottish Reformations, the gospel, then church government. Charles II is brought back. He ejects ministers that won't say that he's the head over the church. And we're part of those ministers and those people that were ejected out of the Church of Scotland. When William and Mary came back in 1619, they established Presbyterianism, but they did it in a way where the civil government established the government of the church. And so we didn't join in. But finally, in 1743, the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Scotland had two pastors, which was enough to establish a presbytery, and you get the Reformed Presbytery. And they started establishing churches. Men began to be raised up to be elders, and pastors, and the church grew. And so basically that's what we have up into Scotland. And the history of the Church of Scotland goes on today, where Andrew Quigley is still one of the last two pastors in the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Scotland today. As we move on to the second point, we have the origin of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in North America. Do you have any questions at this point? How many of you are familiar with this history of 16th and 17th century? A few people? Yeah. Maybe we can go through this in more detail and a little bit slower at some point so we can learn and the great things that happen and appreciate a little bit more. All right, as we begin to look at how did this Reformed Presbyterian Church in North America come about, we have to go back to Ireland. In the 17th century, James I, he actually took over a bunch of Roman Catholic land in Northern Ireland, and he gave it away free. So a lot of these Scottish Presbyterians immigrated from Scotland to Ireland to take this free land because they had no land, they couldn't work, they were being overtaxed, they were being religiously persecuted, so they went to Ireland. In 1729, 5,600 Scotch-Irish, meaning those who were in Scotland and had moved to Northern Ireland, immigrated to Pennsylvania, to Penn's colony. Basically, by that time, they had been very persecuted. You couldn't have a marriage performed unless you were a member of the Church of Scotland. I mean, you were taxed very heavily if you didn't attend the Church of Scotland. And so the Covenanters were part of these people. It wasn't just normal Presbyterians. It was Covenanters also that came over, and they settled in Pennsylvania, South Carolina, New York, and Vermont. And then again, they didn't have pastors at this time. So our church, it existed in what's called societies, where there are people and there was a ruling elder or two, and they would gather together weekly and study the scriptures. In 1740 to 1750, a guy came out of the mainline Presbyterian church. So that would be the OPC, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, VCA, the PCUSA, and the United Presbyterian Church. All these churches came as the mainline Presbyterian Church. They were over here with us. Alexander Hamilton became convicted of our distinctives and the National Covenant and everything. So he became a covenanter pastor. And he would minister to the societies in these years. And basically he would travel from society to society, group of people to group of people, ministering the gospel and preaching. And then this guy, John Cuthbertson, who was ordained under the Church of Scotland in 1747, the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Scotland sent him over to be the minister of the North American societies. And in 1752, he had the first communion service that the Covenanters had in the United States. It was at Middle Octara, PA, kind of in central PA. But we still couldn't be officially Reformed Presbytery. We're still just a society. And you might ask the question, how come we didn't raise up pastors that are elders and stuff? The church was very convicted of the Westminster standards that you needed to have pastors, or you need to have teaching elders in addition to ruling elders to ordain a pastor. So that's why we went on and on without pastors. But in 1774, the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Ireland sent Matthew Lind and Alexander Dobin to America. And with Lind, Dobin, and Cuthbertson, we organized the Reformed Presbyterian Church in America. And it was in 1774. So finally, now we have, it's great, we have three pastors. We actually have a Reformed Presbytery where, you know, things seem to be good. But what happened is there was another group of people called the Seceders. We know them as the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. Our church in Mineola was part of that. They also struggled with the government and the mainline church in Scotland. They came over, and after the Revolutionary War, our convictions of not being able to, well, basically the RP Church and the ARP Church had different views of the relationship of the church to church government. And the Covenanter Church could not join with the ARP because the Covenanter Church believed that you only submit to a legitimate government, civil government. The ARP believed that you submit to whatever government was there, that God has established every government. And the problem is when Britain was over, ruling over the colonies, they were basically a covenant-breaking country. They had broken the Solemn League and Covenant. They had broken the National Covenant. So because of that, the Covenanters wouldn't be a part or wouldn't submit to the government. But when the United States, when we won the Revolutionary War, that little problem went away. And we compromised with the ARP Church and joined with them. Okay, so this first Reformed Presbytery was dissolved and it joined with the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. And there were, our doctrine was in agreement, 98% in agreement, with the exception of this clause of, based on our view of the mediatorial kingship of Christ, that he's head over the church and the state. Yes? Well, it would be not vote, not serve in office, not serve in the military. Well, that in some case it was radical that not pay taxes. People in Scotland and Ireland, I mean, they were the reason that 5,600 people came over is a lot of these people they recognized that the civil magistracy, the king, had broken the covenant that the church had made with the civil government, and because of that, you know, they could no longer support him. So, but this is a major distinction in our church. Does that answer your question? Okay, that comes into our history, by the way. And I'll get to that in a minute. All right, so we were almost a permanent Reformed Presbytery until 1782 when we dissolved the church. And these guys basically broke with the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Ireland and Scotland and became part of the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. So what happened in 1790 to 1792, the RP Church in Ireland sent James McCarrick, and the RP Church of Scotland sent William Keane. They were sent to be pastors of the societies, and they were hoping that maybe that men would be raised up to be pastors and they actually could establish a presbytery. But Keane died, and McCarrick was suspended from ministry for intemperance, drunkenness. And this is kind of interesting to look back, but you have to understand Pennsylvania has pretty mild weather, but in some cases rotten weather. It's rainy and cold and freezing. And these ministers would ride on horseback from house to house, hundreds of miles, you know, a week. And when you went to go make a visitation, someone would give you some whiskey or some wine or some ale to warm you up. And, well, if you made several pastoral visitations, you would get drunk or tutored or something. And so so what happened is this guy became a drunkard, and he was suspended from for intemperance. All right, so we can't be a presbyter again. The one of the pastors dies, the other one can't be he's defrocked. So, and actually it happened one other time, but I didn't have it in the notes. Well, in 1798, the RP Church in Ireland sent James McKinney and William Gidson to minister to the societies. And by the way, they said, do not establish a foreign presbytery, because the last one joined with another church and dissolved. And then these other guys, you know, they couldn't get it together. One died and one's, you know, drank too much. So they were to go minister. And the RP Church in Ireland wanted the RP Church in America to be part of them. And they wanted to control them so that we didn't compromise our convictions and things. But instead, these two guys established a presbytery. And later, the RP Church in Ireland let that happen. But they did it without, they constituted a presbytery in 1798. They didn't ask permission, and actually they kind of went against their instructions. But this is the first permanent Reformed presbytery. Okay, so we finally are a permanent body in 1798 with pastors. We're an actual presbytery. In 1802, the church grew under the ministry of these guys to have three presbyteries, a northern, a southern, and a middle presbytery. And in 1807, we wrote the RPCNA, Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America, testimony to the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now, something that differentiates us from the PCA and the OP Church is, rather than rewriting parts of the Westminster Confession, we have just written a testimony. And we say, this is what we believe. And there's a couple points in the Westminster Confession that we take exception to. And instead of rewriting the Westminster Confession of Faith, our testimony interprets it or says we don't hold to this. The statement that the Pope is the Antichrist, we soften that statement. There's a statement about marriage we soften. But what you see is that in 1807, now we are an entity. We have three presbyteries. We have our own testimony. And in that testimony, we can apply the doctrine of the Westminster Confession to our situation and maybe context of doctrinal error that has come up since then. And it was published. And then in 1809, we established the first synod with three presbyteries and seven ministers. So the first synod of the RPCNA was in 1809. And so we come from that. Before I get to kind of the fun stuff and maybe the dirty laundry of stuff we have in here, do you have any questions about? Yeah, Bill. Yeah, they're half our size, but in a much smaller area.
Yeah. And when we were here before, I was really impressed with how whole churches were both in harmony and even service and visit to different churches. Is that its roots?
The RP Church.
Scotland people moving to Northern Ireland. Is that why the church is so strong?
Yeah. Yeah, and they were somewhat shielded from all of this, a lot of the martyrs, or like all of the persecution. They were persecuted, but that's why many left. But yeah, really, the church in Northern Ireland was stronger than the church in Scotland. Ultimately, what was it in the 80s, maybe, or the 70s? The seminary in Scotland, the RPCS seminary in Scotland, dissolved. So everyone was educated in the Belfast Theological Hall.
Can we seek reparations from
Well, okay, so, you know, that whole 1690 thing, it seems like we're somewhat, you know, we didn't join in into the In 1690, we didn't join back in the Church of Scotland when they became, when it became Presbyterian, and the Parliament just said, boom, this is your church. You don't have a say. This is the church. There were a lot of things that went on. I mean, one of the things is they didn't address at all the Covenanters, the massacre of the Covenanters. And so there was a lot going on. It was a very complicated decision not to go back in there. But there's an issue on covenanting. Like, are we supposed to be held under the national covenant in Scotland? We're in America. We have a different government, things like that. There was a split in the RP church in the 19th century, early 19th century, called the Steelites, who said, yeah, we still have to hold to the solemn league of covenant and national covenant. And they're just a splinter group. I don't even know. I don't think they have a pastor. They had a revitalization in the last few 30 years, but we can't seek remunerations really from them. But, you know, there's a lot to understand our position, understand why we are who we are, why we're still small, and we hold tightly to these convictions. We do need to study the history a little bit more in depth. Are there any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Isn't that great? I mean, this is radical because, the PCUSA became illegitimate. Well, they became doctrinally liberal, but not by confession, but by the end of the 19th century. But by the time 1920s and 30s, they had just become liberal and denied the scriptures, the authority of the scriptures and inerrancy of scriptures. Now they hold to they don't hold to biblical Christianity, I would say. I mean, confessionally. There are good people in the PCUSA, but they're totally liberal. Except for a few people, and you know they've been here as long as we have, but you know God for some reason has preserved us for 200 years. I mean, and more than that, but it's wonderful that we get to say this is the 200th synod. And as someone from an outsider coming in, I really appreciate that. Yes. You can. You know, we can look critically at that decision. I have a more optimistic view of it. It was a revival, and you know, people had true saving faith. There are a lot of people that didn't, of course, but you know, that's something to investigate. And actually, as the RPCNA, especially in the United States, we struggled with that a lot. And actually, you know, you look back at the ARP Church, or the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church in Scotland, they didn't hold our position. But that was almost the only thing we disagreed on, but we didn't join with them. So it wasn't until we softened our views on that a little bit that we started uniting with the ARP. And every union with the ARP church, we compromised that position. It takes more study, but it is hard to understand it today. It wasn't culturally out of the question that everyone was a believer, and most people were believers, and there were, and everything. But that's one of the things to look at and examine and be critical of ourselves. I don't necessarily think it was that bad, but there, I think there's room for criticism and discussion. Like, what did we do? Did we do this right? Yeah, John. The interesting part. Yeah. In light of Melissa's comment, because of our view, which I pretty much have not discussed this mediatorial kingship view in detail, because of it, James McKinney established our basis of political dissent to the United States Constitution. Basically, the Constitution does not take the Ten Commandments to be the basis for law, and the Constitution doesn't claim Christ as king over the church and the state. And because of that, and because of our heritage of what we were doing in Scotland, we, in our view of the mediatorial kingship, we established this practice of political dissent. At that time, you weren't part of the army. You didn't vote. You didn't serve in public office because you would have to take an oath to the Constitution that was basically a sinful oath, swearing allegiance to a government basically over Christ because they didn't recognize Christ as their king. In 1967, yes, ma'am. Yes, Beth. Yeah, and you know, I have a whole study that it'd be interesting to do. I wanted to put more of that detail in there. But in 1967, we repented from this decision. And we said we didn't really have the data to really make this difficult stance. And really, there's a long history of trying to be involved in the government, yet still maintain our consciences, not deny Christ. And in the Civil War, many people were involved, and we didn't discipline them. We established what Beth's referring to as the explanatory declaration, that you take the oath of the Constitution, but you also take this oath. You also say, by the way, I will support it as long as I do not have to deny my allegiance to Jesus Christ. Ultimately, we realized we didn't have the basis legally to make this decision that it was sinful to swear allegiance to the oath of the Constitution. But, you know, by the way, that is why we are the Reformed Presbyterian Church, this position of political dissent and this application of the mediatorial kingship. It's why we haven't joined with other churches. But in 1967, our church didn't go liberal, but they looked at the scriptures again and looked at the basis for our argument, and we decided we could no longer bind men's consciences, and it became an issue of Christian liberty where it's up to you before Christ to determine if you can serve in the military, take the oath of the Constitution, vote for a non-believer, or vote at all. So before 1967, if you're a member of the church, you couldn't vote. There are good aspects of this because in the early 19th century, you couldn't be a member and hold slaves. Okay? And this was in the early 1800s. Real quick, in 1810, our seminary was established. Classes were first held. By the way, the seminary will be 200 years old next year. That's profound. Princeton is crazy liberal now. It was the mainline Presbyterian seminary. Union Seminary in New York City is, I don't know, it's not Christian in any way. Maybe they say there might be. All of these mainline Presbyterian, Union in Virginia, which was Presbyterian, Southern Presbyterian, it's liberal. Yale's liberal. But our Presbyterian seminary has remained Orthodox for 200 years. So that's something really sweet to see, God's hand of providence. Geneva College was established in 1848, and then later it moved to Beaver Falls, still in existence, is still under our synod. And then a good thing is we took a strong stand against slavery, where other people didn't. The Southern Presbyterians, like Dabney and Thornwell, these guys, they actually, they were part of the Confederacy. They defended the practice of slavery. But the RP Church, all our Southern churches dissolved, because we said you could not be an elder, you couldn't really be a member and hold slaves. But in 1816, we participated in the American Colonization Society, which we were involved in the Underground Railroad. We were involved in emancipation issues, and also in that work of establishing that nation called Liberia, which is in Africa for liberated slaves. And then in 1866, in 1862, we established many missions to slaves who are freed. And Selma, Alabama, our church there is still a work that's a fruit of that. And then in 1866, you know, we're this small, somewhat strange denomination, but we had Negro students come to Geneva College to study. We had slaves come to, you know, a white school and study. We had our former slaves. We had black men in seminary. So, I mean, we really sought to work out our faith and really make a testimony and work to end slavery. We are a small denomination. I think at our largest, we're about 10,000 people, and that was in the 19th century. So you think of the population differences between now and then. We have had strong foreign missions for such a small denomination. From 1856 to 1962, we had a mission station in Syria, and Syria was under France at the time. And, you know, people came to saving faith. There was a church established, and it existed a while after we left. There was a hospital and schools. It was very strong. In 1896 to now, Cyprus, we've had a mission in Cyprus, and many people. How many are related to someone who is a missionary in Cyprus here? Beth and Melissa? Yeah. Many people, I mean, we've had guys that are, this has been a prosperous mission. In 1895 and 1951, we had a mission to China and Manchuria. And they stayed until the Chinese government kicked them out. And then Sam Boyle and company, on their way back to the United States from Hong Kong, the United States, stopped in Japan. And Sam Boyle said, whoa, wait a minute. Let's do a work here. And it's amazing that God has totally blessed that mission work in Japan that seemed probably, wasn't there, but it seemed like it would have been very discouraging to be kicked out of a nation. They went to Japan and God has so prospered our mission work there that we have a presbytery with five churches. And, you know, the Japanese church is very strong, one of our strongest presbyteries. Then there's the alcohol issue, maybe not one of the highlights of our time. We got involved in the prohibition movement in the 19th century. And in 1857, we required abstinence from alcohol of any sort from all our members. So to be a member, a term of communion or membership was you could not drink alcohol. Then in 1980, we re-examined the scriptures and came to the position and repented that we couldn't bind people's consciences to say it is inherently sinful to drink alcohol. And so we backed off on that. And our statement said, it is altogether wise and prudent to abstain from alcohol. So we said it's wise not to, but if we're going to be biblical, we cannot force you to abstain from drinking alcohol. And for many years, our pastors from the 1920s on, our pastors and elders had to take vow 8, which required them never to drink alcohol. And in 1998, we repented of that. We remove that abstinence requirement. Now, I'm not saying that alcohol is a great thing to just revel in, but what the church did is they didn't go down a slippery slope of changing everything. There are enough people like J.G. Voss that had problems with this, so they not problems with drinking, but problems saying that alcohol is a sin. To drink alcohol is a sin, and so we said, you know what? We've been wrong. The scriptures say that it's not inherently sinful to drink. Drunkenness is sinful. And so we couldn't bind people's conscience. And by the way, this Christian liberty is a theology that was well articulated in the Westminster Assembly. To end, I just want to, I have kind of, what is, when you look at history, you need to realize that history is a study of God's works of providence, and his works of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing all his creatures and all their actions. And so hopefully as you look at our history, you can see that God has preserved us and he has guided us. And kind of the lesson I'd like to take from this is comes from Westminster Confession, chapter 25, paragraph 5. The purest churches under heaven are subject to both a mixture and error, and some have so degenerated and as to become no churches of Christ, but synagogues of Satan. Nevertheless, there shall be always a church on earth to worship God according to his will. So we, the RPCNA, we're not a perfect church, but we have strived to be a body of believers who will worship God according to his will. So when you look back at our history, you can be critical. And Melissa's comment, it's legitimate to ask that question and make that and do the study. But we have really strived to worship according to God's will. And do you guys have any questions about stuff we've covered? Yes. Yeah, on 1557 to 1560. Actually, there was a battle and stuff in that, but it's kind of complicated. Because a lot of it was going on with the English Reformation at the same time. A shorter answer is in the Second Reformation, Charles I came up with his army, and we gathered together. And have you seen that banner right there? That banner was flown, and the Covenanters fought Charles and won in that. But in the 1580s, in the First Reformation, there wasn't a huge battle. Actually, Parliament... people in Parliament had become believers and things like that. You know, we don't necessarily say that it was right for these guys to go in and murder or assassinate him, but at least without, you need to get in their context. It was medieval, a bloody time, and it was somewhat war. And so, James Melville and his brother Andrew Melville became major leaders in the Reformation. Actually, I can't remember what happened to Charles, John Wesley, and Carmichael. They were all taken. Some of them died in slavery in the French galleys. But I can't remember what happened. But James Melville and his brother Andrew Melville, they did a lot of work. Like in this battle between 1560 and 1567 of like battling over who's over the church, the state or the church and stuff. James Melville's brother played a big role in that. So, I would say the Covenanters did. Alexander Peden. Is it Bishop Sharp? Well, there's another point in time, like later on, where Robert Lytton was one of the bishop, and I believe it's Sharp was the other bishop. Lytton was in Glasgow, Sharp was in Edinburgh. And some men saw him coming in his carriage with his family, and they grabbed him and took him away and killed him and sent his family on their way. And that basically enraged everyone, and then that kind of lit up this persecution. So that wasn't necessarily the right way to go about doing things. I would be interested in like talking more about the complicated history, but it is a different context than we have today. I mean, people were getting burned at the stake because of their faith in Christ and that they wouldn't worship in the Roman Catholic Church and things like that. So it really is kind of a complicated history. So I don't have a good answer, a real good answer right now. Any other questions? If not, we'll end with that. Thank you.